by the light switch who watches over you. Make a little birdhouse in your soul, not to put too fine a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul.
Hello and welcome to Gaze From Home. My name is Matt Gower. Steve is still away. He is in BC as we speak. We will be back next week at some point with a regular episode. In the meantime, though, here's a bonus episode of sorts. I interviewed Tim Newby about his upcoming book, The Life and Times of Forgotten Baseball Legend Pete Browning, the original Louisville Slugger. So that will be available in September sometime this year, 2024, out of the University Press of Kentucky. So look for it wherever you buy your books. It's a great read. Here is my talk with Tim. Tim Newby, welcome to Jays From Home. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here and to talk some baseball and talk some Pete Browning.
We have some similar backgrounds. I was kind of doing some research on you. Like you, I guess you're coming from a music journalistic background. You're into the following around jam bands and bluegrass, and that's kind of where I my interests lie as well. So has baseball always been a passion for you, or did it kind of evolve from music, or where do those fit in?
Most of my writing has tended to be about music and kind of more roots to your music, but I've always been a sports fan. I played football and lacrosse in college, loved baseball. I'm from Baltimore, I love the Orioles. So I know there's going to be some tension between us right now. but I've always loved baseball. But most of my writing had been mostly focused on music. I had kind of written a few other sports things here and there, but as far as like a whole book, no. But kind of when I stumbled across the story of Pete Browning and I knew a little bit about him, it sort of actually had come out of my last book, which was Leftover Salmon 30 Years of Festival. We were kind of out with the band and my wife and I were going to take a little road trip up to Louisville. We were in Nashville with them. They were playing at the Ryman and we went to the Louisville Slugger factory and they kind of told the story of Pete just very offhandedly. And I remember my wife was like, well, that dude sounds super interesting. Mm-hmm. And from there we were kind of like, huh, well, maybe I'm going to look into this. And so I've always mostly written music, but the sports thing is a definite passion, something I have a super interest in. As far as writing a book, this was my first sports book to do, but I've written some other sports stuff.
Yeah, like as far as your other books that you've written Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard Driving Sound and Its Legacy, as well as, like you said, the Leftover Salmon book, 30 Years of Festival, ! So what is your baseball background? We heard a lot about your music. Where did you kind of develop your passion for baseball?
I grew up, my dad was in the military. We grew up all around the world. I was living in Texas in the 80s in the era of the Braves on TBS. So I was a gigantic Del Murphy fan. I love baseball from there. Eventually settled in Baltimore and I've been an Orioles fan since I've moved back here. And I moved back here way back in high school. So that's, 30 years ago. But I've always loved sports. And despite never having played a lot, I mostly played lacrosse. And that's because I couldn't hit a curveball. So I figured it was better to go out and run around than to try and hit a curveball. But I played baseball, but I always had a passion for that. Loved it. Loved the sport. I love just the pace of it. And, coming from a completely different world of lacrosse that's nonstop in action, I love like the steady pace of baseball and I always say the attention span it takes to kind of watch baseball and be into baseball and devoted to that. So I've always loved that.
Now, would you find some similarities and some commonalities between, following the long baseball season and following around a jam band, throughout their tour stops?
I think many of those bands can require that same long attention span too. Salmon can definitely test your attention span throughout the night. So yeah, that's a really good similarity too. 162 game season or a three set show that stretches all night definitely have a lot of similarities.
Yeah, it's like pitch mix and set lists and things like that.
Yeah, and that's true. It is. The way a band approaches it. They're setting up for the night and what their audience is like and where they're at. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like it's every night is kind of different.
Maybe a little bit less weed in the mix though.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what decade you're talking about. There are definitely plenty of players who have would have been very happy with the jam band world.
Yeah, no, and I've heard stories about San Francisco too. So, all right, but so now you mentioned why you're here. You're here about your book. I don't remember if we mentioned the title of the book. It's called The Life and Times of Forgotten Baseball Legend Pete Browning, the Original Louisville Slugger. So why write about Pete Browning? Tell me what piqued your interest.
So kind of like I said, we were out on the road with Salmon, and then my wife and I left Nashville, took a little road trip to Louisville, and on the Louisville Slugger Factor tour, we were just, you know, checking it out. We heard this story. I remember that night we were having dinner, having some beers, and just talking with this guy. And I have always very much gravitated to stories of kind of underdogs, but that are influential. And if you look at my Baltimore Bluegrass book, that kind of is that. Leftover Salmon is kind of that. So I've always kind of liked that story. My wife and I were just talking about him. I'm just literally sitting there, like, while we're eating dinner, like, looking on our phone, like, oh, that's a pretty cool story. And I knew a little bit about him. And I said, you know, I'm going to take the rest of the summer, this was in July, and just see what's out there. Like, is there enough? You know, and there was no book out there. There was not a lot of information. I said, let me just see. Like, you know, I kind of thought it was weird that somebody who has this kind of role with Louisville Slugger would have nothing out there. So I just kind of dove into it. And, you know, I think what really sparked my interest is there's so much myth about Pete, mm-hmm. you know, him being illiterate or all the weird things he did. And there's 100% truth there, but I really got into like the myth versus like the truth on that a little bit. And I kind of love that because he, I think, was more than happy to play up some of that myth about him. So it just became a really interesting story to kind of dive into with that and to find out about him. And then, you know, I love the idea of 19th century baseball. We often don't think of, you know, we kind of think of baseball in 1903, we're going to start kind of the modern day game. But 19th century baseball was so weird and unique. And, you know, besides things like not wearing gloves, I mean, there's no mound for a long time and they're changing the number of strikes and balls and stuff. So I just think that becomes really neat. And I love both sides of those stories. You have this early years of developing a baseball and this really weird individual who was really good, who also had a lot of these eccentricities. He drank a ton. I mean, you know, he probably had more hits drunk than he did sober. And I just found it super intriguing, interesting, and then still played and succeeded at a very high level individually.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned myth, and we'll get into a lot. We'll get into this a little bit. But which came first? Was the Louisville Slugger, like, was he the original Louisville Slugger, or was the company named after, was he named after the company? What's the story there?
And that's a good question. So I think like one of the questions, and to kind of go down a little longer rabbit hole, is, you know, there's nothing that at the time that says like Pete went and had the bat turned. There's enough evidence and stories of that. But he was nicknamed the Louisville Slugger. So his name comes first. And Hillish and Bradsey, which is the company that makes Louisville Sluggers, they weren't really making bats at the time. They did stuff that they could turn on, you know, chairs and stair rails, those types of things. They weren't really making bats at the time. Bats at the time were something that, you know, didn't have as much care and attention to them. Pete mm-hmm. was very into bats. Mm-hmm. So he had a bat turned by them. And then eventually they evolve and realize there is this business for bats. But a lot of questions have always come up about his role with that. Well, you know, there's no like signed document at the time. And to me, like, there's enough other evidence at the time of his involvement in there. And I always said, why would there be more evidence of his role in 1884? They don't even become a company making bats until the latter half of the decade. So like, it wasn't like he went to this company to get bats made and they said, we're going to get him. It just was a convenience. They were in his hometown. He broke mm-hmm. the bat. They offered, hey, we could turn you and make you a new bat. He used them and liked them. He kept ordering from there. And then their business took off from there. And they don't really start using that term Louisville Slugger until towards the end of his career. And then it really kind of becomes famous over kind of the next decade or two as they really start ramping their business up. So long way to get there. He was the Louisville Slugger first. They were not even making baseball bats. And then eventually they get into that. And he kind of had that first one there. And there's a lot more into it than just, you know, that simple story there. But
yeah. And at that time, in the book, you also mentioned there are like a lot of different kind of shapes of bats. Mm-hmm. Was he the first to kind of come up with the idea of a barreled bat, or were there different designs kind of going around there?
I wouldn't say he was the first to come up with that. They were using those different types of bats. I think what he should be credited is having the first custom made bat to how he wanted it. This size, this weight, this length, all of that. And then also the idea of kind of the care for bats. At the time, bats were more of an afterthought. Like, guys would, you know, break a bat and just nail it back together. And it wasn't as much care into your bat, thinking that it was a tool that you were using. So I think he should get credit. As far as developing the barrel, no, he didn't necessarily like sit down and design the shape or the size, like the barrel of it. he came up and said, here's what bats look like. Here's what I would like to have done for me. And then he kept going and having those. And he even had for a while where he would travel with lots of different bats and say, like, I'm going to use this bat because this guy throws faster, so I want a lighter bat, or I want a heavier, whatever it was. And he tried to match up bats to pitchers to take advantage of different things and stuff. So he really put a lot of care and kind of is the modern forerunner of, like, you know, traveling with lots of bats. And, you know, if you break a bat, you have another one, as opposed to just like, yeah, get another one, you know, off the pile over there and see what happens. He wanted his special bats.
Yeah, and his upkeep kind of reminded me of the opposite way that Ted Williams used to keep his bats, take care of his bats. Because you mentioned that he would soak his bats in water. I think Ted Williams, maybe he did the opposite. He like humidified them or something. But it kind of, there were some similarities there. Was he unique in his routines and superstitions with the upkeep?
I think he was, and I think it goes both. I think you're talking about a man who education becomes very limited. He had a lot of health issues, hearing-wise, and eventually he drops out of school. So I think a lot of his worldviews are formed on what he thinks. You know, there's not a lot of scientific fact there. But he also did want to meticulously care for his bats. Now, he liked a really heavy bat, right? I mean, he believed the physics that a heavy bat's going to hit a ball, it's going to travel really far. So he soaked him to make him heavier. And, you know, he did things like that. I mean, his bat was huge. It was massive, you know, by modern standards. But he did take care of them. You know, he would oil them and do all kinds of care. And you know, a lot of those ideas have changed as we've come to understand the science of more what's happening things. But a lot of those ways he took care of things was what he believed or what he thought was right based on his kind of limited education. And that even kind of goes into how he takes care of himself. I mean, he wasn't necessarily, you know, out there working out, eating healthy meals. I mean, he had his own weird kind of health regimen of what he thought was going to make him a better player.
Well, and the results that he was seeing on the field, as far as he was concerned, was paying off, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you look at what he did, and again, I'm not going to go down the rabbit hole of stats, but like, he was one of the better hitters of that decade, just flat out. I mean, when you look at something as simple and easy to kind of measure his batting average, right? I mean, he was getting lots of hits. He was putting, you know, bat on ball and getting on base a lot. And I think that's something easy that anybody can look at. I mean, we can get into like all those different kinds of numbers. And, you know, if you don't understand, you don't understand. But to me, that's an easy one that the average person can look at. He went up the bat and he got on base more than most people did. You know, now he played on horrible teams, which is going to impact all those other types of stats. But yeah, I mean, he was hitting and he was a good hitter and he hit far. And again, it's a different time period. You know, I mean, they're playing in these fields that, you know, are bigger, maybe don't even have fences. So it wasn't like he was hitting home runs, you know, like because sometimes these fields are had non-existent fences and stuff. So it kind of changed some of those stats we understand. So I, you know, when I talk to people who maybe don't have as much understanding of certain baseball stats, I'll talk about just batting average. It's simple. He went up, he put the bat on the ball better than just about anybody at the time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And what happened to his bats? Because you mentioned he had like a basement full of baseball bats, and I think Honus Wagner took one of his bats and used it. Like, are they on display in any museums, like the Hall of Fame?
I'm not sure if his bat is in the Hall of Fame. I know they have one of his bats at the Louisville Slugger Museum, but there's not a lot of, he had no family. He wasn't ever married, had no kids. So there's not a lot of evidence of what happened to his bats afterwards, but what had happened is he believed each bat had a predetermined number of hits. And when it was done, it was done. And he would retire it to his basement. And some of them he would actually have turned and used as like stair balusters, like on the stairs. But he often would tag them and with what the bat did, and maybe like a very special moment in 1887, I with three on the base, I lined one out to center and, you know, knocked in the game winning run or something like that. But Honus Wagner, he kind of befriended Honus, was playing in Louisville at the time. And there was a bat that he liked and Pete gifted it to him and said, you know, you can have this bat then. And so Honus Wagner used it for a while. And, you know, then obviously he goes on to put his name on Louisville Sluggers as well. And so, you know, it's not much of a stretch to think that these bats that were being turned by this company that would become what we know of as kind of the Louisville Slugger company, you know, this is his first exposure to it because he has somebody who's saying, look, these guys were making, you know, my bats over here. It's not a stretch to think that that's where that connection comes from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that he was a heavy drinker. And the main reason for that, I think, was because he was kind of self-medicating because he had mastoiditis. Now, can you explain that affliction?
So he had an ear infection when he was younger. And nowadays, if we had that, we would get antibiotics and it'd be something we wouldn't think about. But at the time, it was a pretty life-threatening disease. There wasn't a lot of, there wasn't antibiotics, obviously. Surgeries for it were very last kind of resort. So he developed something called mastoiditis, which is basically like fluid getting trapped in your ear and your ear canal. And basically it started rendering him deaf. It caused him to have kind of severe vertigo, dizziness, headaches kind of throughout his life. And so to me, it's the defining aspect of who he is, because he becomes not completely illiterate, but he drops out of school and has very limited education. Well, it was hard for him to hear. He drinks a lot to self-medicate because you've got this massive pain in your head. You've got all these other factors going on. Now, just like anything, I'm sure that, you know, as he started drinking, it just becomes habit. You know what I mean? What one's vices, you know, now become habits kind of thing. So I think that like that obviously kind of snowballed in there. And there's a lot of evidence that he drank less in the off season, so that it wasn't just completely he was drinking. I mean, he would have obviously experienced more pain during the season. He's running, which would aggravate his head. It was hot. The heat would have aggravated some of those issues. In the summer, there was less physical activity. And there's some evidence that he definitely drank less in the off season. So again, you can see a connection between really trying to self-medicate and get himself out on the field just to be able to play.
How difficult was it for Pete to play with baseball? Because he was with the deteriorating hearing, like how difficult was that for him?
I mean, I think, you know, there's talk of how it helped him at the plate because he could focus, right? That's the only time you got to worry about it. But in the field, he has long been regarded as a pretty awful fielder. And I don't think that's entirely true. I don't think he was a great fielder. But when you read evidence of his younger years, he was playing second base, shortstop, and third base. And I don't think you're putting somebody who's a bad fielder in those positions. Mm-hmm. I think a number of things happen. I think he was pretty athletic and was pretty good in the field, but he'd been run over a number of times. And, you know, with limited hearing, you're not necessarily going to hear a runner approaching. And he would often stand with one foot or knee kind of angling towards the runner in the hopes that that runner would run into the knee if he didn't hear him coming. So I think some of those things start giving the perception of how bad a fielder he is, because then he started really standing back out of the base pass and stepping back further. And, you know, now all of a sudden you're not as effective a fielder because you're trying to stand further back. So eventually he was moved to the outfield. In the outfield, he often acquiesced fly balls to teammates because, again, he couldn't hear whether they were calling for it or not. So he just gave everything up. And I think all this goes in to kind of give the perception of him being a truly horrendous fielder when he wasn't that bad as kind of is portrayed. But then he also was happy to kind of portray that as well. And the other side of that is because of his hearing, he kind of would talk about himself, because I always feel that's the one thing he was solely confident about. So with his fielding, he could then say, look, I'm here to hit. I'm not here to field. And so all the shortcomings that was causing him on the field, he could kind of spin it like, look, I'm brought here to hit the ball. I'm not brought here to run down flies in the outfield. Anybody can do that, but can anybody do what I do at the plate? So, you know, I think his hearing really developed, his lack of hearing really developed who he was, both on the field and off, and really impacted his play on the field because he obviously couldn't hear teammates or runners or things like that.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book too, like he was kind of a player ahead of his time, because he would have fit right into the DH era for sure. You mentioned that it affected, you know, he became very confident in his own abilities. Did all players, like, he almost had a language of his own, you could say. Like, did all players speak that way? Was it just the language of the time, or was he kind of unique in his flamboyant, boastful style, the way he spoke?
I mean, and there's other players who can be flamboyant, but he was definitely very unique. And again, I think some of it was a bit of a defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. He was known to like speak very loudly about himself in first person. And he would kind of talk about, you know, old Pete, and Pete's going to do this. And so he often spoke about himself. And I feel it was an easy way for him to, you know, if he didn't have a conversation and couldn't hear what was being said very clear, he's confident about himself. He can talk about that. He also, the name Pete was a bit of a defense mechanism. He used to call everybody that because he couldn't hear when names were being introduced to him. So then he started referring to himself as Pete. And I think all this goes into develop this big, loud personality. He would often talk about how good he was. And he was known to kind of get off trains in new cities and be like, the champion batter of the American Association has arrived. And he was very loud, but there's also stories about how he actually was a pretty shy individual really deep down. So I think he developed this whole loud, flamboyant kind of personality as a bit of a defense mechanism. He was also known to like dress very flashy for the time, you know, and in nice suits and looking really good. So he kind of had this whole persona. Like, again, I feel it was a way to deflect from all of his other kind of, you know, shortcomings and lacks and faults and health issues.
Yeah, but he kind of sounds like he held himself up as and acted very much like a superstar, though, even though despite his shyness. Is there a player that you would like a modern player in today's baseball that you could compare his playing style to?
Yeah, you know, that's tough. I mean, again, he definitely is would have fit as a DH. Maybe someone like David Ortiz, who had a bit of a fun personality and, you know, maybe has some defensive shortcomings as well, you know, who just go up there and hit the ball. It's kind of tough to make some of those comparisons, I think, because the game is still a little different from now and then. But I think, yeah, any kind of DH, and I'm trying to give a good flamboyant DH, you know what I mean? Sometimes I think of DH as being like hardworking guys, and he definitely was a hardworking guy, but he didn't want people to know that he was a hardworking guy. He wanted people to think that he just was natural at it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And you also mentioned the American Association, and how there were so many changes going on in the late part of the century there. And one of the interesting parts of the book, chapters of the book, the Brotherhood War, was really interesting to me, because this was a point in time where baseball kind of could have gone a number of different directions. How different would MLB look like if the Players League and the American Associations were able to work together to fight the National League?
I mean, it could have been vastly different. So at the time in 1890, you actually had three major leagues. You had the National League, you had the American Association, who was kind of, they're not the American League, which I think is always the confusion. They're not. They were a completely separate league. They weren't the American League that we think of now. They were a separate league. And then you had what's called the Players League. And the Players League was formed from this organization called the Brotherhood. And the Brotherhood basically wanted to have better treatment, better pay in baseball. I mean, some of the same things that players are still fighting for and been fighting for, you know. Mm-hmm, and at the time, obviously, there was no free agency, and, you know, teams controlled your rights forever. So they formed this league, and the idea was that they wanted to not just be kind of the players. They wanted to have some ownership value as well. They wanted to be more than just simply kind of the hired guns. You know, so it's a lot. I mean, if you had a league that succeeds where players have more of an ownership value, that's vastly different than any professional league that we have existing today. You know, it's also interesting. And at the time, that league had all the best players. Most of the best players from the National League migrated over. Most of the best players from the American Association migrated over. So in that 1 year, the Players League was probably the premier league, but you literally had three competing leagues, and some cities had three competing teams at the time. You know, they would have games on the same day, so fans had to choose between which league they wanted to go to. But, you know, that can be vastly different. And mostly, I think, from how players are involved in their contracts and how things are decided, that would have been a huge difference than what we kind of had the modern system out of, you know, an owner and a team. Mm-hmm. It's had more of an ownership role in a team. That's, I mean, revolutionary.
Yeah, they're definitely not. There's not a partnership in modern baseball between the players and the owners, for sure. And I think
that's a better word. What they were trying to form at the time was a partnership. It's a better word for it.
Yeah, and another thing that could have been a lot different was I think, you know, had they worked together, the AA and the Players League, it could have had severe ramifications for the antitrust law as well, I think.
Absolutely. And it was interesting, and that's kind of a whole another thing, is the Players League, like, it seems they should have teamed up more with the American Association and kind of taken on the National League together, the two of them. But I think because so many of the players are coming from the NL and they already had an automatic bias towards the American Association, they just never went down that route. And it would have made natural sense. Let's form these two here. We will have the bulk of players, and, you know, we then can try and establish a new kind of league and how it's supposed to be. But it just didn't really happen, and it fizzled out. And, you know, some shrewd owners from the NL kind of helped bring about the end of the Players League.
Yeah, for sure. Now. Because all the players kind of looked down on the American Association, is that one of the main reasons why Pete Browning never made it into the Hall of Fame?
I think that definitely has a lot to do with it. There was a natural bias there. I think also, too, I mean, we're not talking, I mean, it's another 50, 40 years till the first Hall of Fame class goes in after him. And, you know, it was a different time as far as information. And I think a lot of knowledge and familiarity with the American Association had kind of been lost, right? We talked about the NL, but the American Association, you know, folds in 1891. So people kind of forget about that. And I think that really hurt a lot of those guys who played there, but I don't think there was a huge difference talent-wise between leagues at the time. You saw players moving back and forth between leagues, and they basically finished relatively in the same spot. If they were a good hitter, they finished in about the same spot. So I don't think there was a lot of differences between the leagues there. You know, I think from Pete's standpoint too, is he then goes to the Players League, which basically has most of the best players, and he wins a batting title that year. So I think he kind of proved that. And I do think it's interesting because at the time, I think he was viewed as one of the elite hitters, you know, but I think that gets lost over time as the NL kind of becomes the obviously dominant voice in baseball, that, and obviously you have the American League. But, you know, when you read articles like 10 years, 20 years after, they still refer back to like how great he was as one of the greatest hitters of that generation. But eventually that goes away, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that being in that league has definitely given him a bigger hurdle to getting into the Hall of Fame.
Sure. Now there's a, like, I remember I was reading how like, you know, years later there, I think Ty Cobb is a good example of this, where like the batting titles were decided with incorrect numbers. Mm-hmm. How difficult was it to wade through all the information and actually research this book?
So most of the batting numbers have been corrected at some point by people who are above my pay grade, you know, and that. But what I also did is I literally went out and basically logged every Pete's game as I could find it. Wow. Per box scores. And then I often would try and compare box scores from both games that are playing, you know, and usually they were the same, but that way I had an idea and you could see, okay, yes, this team's right, this team's right. You know, most of those kind of numbers have been corrected over time. You know, there was a batting title in 1886 that was, you know, decided well after the fact when, you know, they eventually awarded it to Guy Hecker, you know, and there was a lot of stories even at the time that batting titles, it was unknown who won them for weeks or months after a while. It took a while to kind of figure it out. For me, I feel most of those numbers have been solidified. I feel like checking it. Like I said, I basically just kept a log of every game I went through, you know, recorded what I had from him and then compared it against any other sources I could find as far as other, you know, other box scores or, you know, if there was another one and see if there's any difference in those. And I feel at this point, all those numbers are pretty right, you know?
Yeah, that's definitely something that I would not be able to wade through personally. it can be pretty tedious, I guess. And I bet your eyes were pretty tired by the end of the writing process.
You know, it's funny. I did notice because I was looking at a lot of like old newspapers, but it gave a really good sense of who he was. And it allowed you to see certain trends and patterns that are often overlooked, right? Things that we would take for granted nowadays, hit streaks, right? Like that's mm-hmm. something we always talk about, but you don't hear as much talk about it. So it was interesting to like see some of those hit streaks that he had in there. And he had some pretty impressive hit streaks going on, you know, and those types of things, or when he would do things like he let off multiple games in a row and, you know, with a hit or whatever it was, like all those types of things that we take for granted now in our stats that you can just call up at a touch of a button, to see all of those, which aren't always referred back to kind of see some of, you know, his greatness kind of unfolding in box scores. And it was kind of neat as a kid of the 80s who learned how to, you know, figure out averages and stuff, because my dad taught me how to do it, to like go back and look at box scores, because we don't do that anymore, right? We just pull it up on the phone. But to like look at a paper, I had that old school box score and be like, okay, and what did he do? It was a lot of fun to kind of get back into that for a while.
Yeah, no, that's definitely how I entered into the baseball world, like reading all like the Baseball Weekly and all the AAA and minor league stats and everything. Now here's the big question. Do you think that Pete Browning will ever make it into the Hall of Fame?
You know, I'm going to probably say no. I mean, I know that they're coming up this year. They're voting on some more potential 19th century players again. So there's a chance. I've talked with some people who have kind of said, you know, we feel we've got enough 19th century players in there. What's the point at this point, right? Like going back. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. That's tough. You know, there's definitely a handful more players. You can definitely go, all these guys are definitely worthy candidates. But you figure the further away we get from it, the further it recedes in our memory. And it's not like we can't pull up game film and go watch this, right? And I think maybe part of the problem now is we're getting too reliant on all these advanced metrics. You know, we're looking at it and that's helpful. But I think my thing is, if at the time people, sports writers, fans, players thought somebody was the greatest, why is their opinion less important than you know, now when we're just doing it because we're going to throw some numbers on there and go, well, you know, his mm-hmm. war isn't as good as this, you know, or something like that. I think he is still a borderline. I think deep down inside, I don't think he will. I think he definitely deserves. I mean, some of the things he has done, like he is in a very small elite company. He has had a 400 hit season, one of only four players to win batting titles in multiple leagues. I mean, he had a stretch of 9 years where he finished in the top three. I mean, he's got a pretty impressive resume when you look at it, you know, but it's 19th century baseball. And, you know, so I think it'd be fun to see him get in there. I mean, you know, I have no personal stake in there. I think it'd be great to see. I think his story is super cool. And he is an important figure in baseball, and the Hall of Fame is recognizing those best players. And I think he was the best player of that era, so it would be important. But, you know, who am I?
Yeah, well, no, but I thought you made a good point of it. And, like, with his numbers plus his legacy as far as, you know, his influence on baseball bats, I think he's an important part of baseball's story. And I'd like to see him get in there eventually, you know, like maybe closer to the 200th anniversary of Major League Baseball, we might see a resurgence of people wanting to see more history, but hopefully we'll get there sooner. If you have some time, I wanted to talk about your modern day team, the Orioles.
Sure.
Yeah. they're a really interesting team to me.
They're a lot of fun to watch.
There's been a lot of things going on for the Orioles over the past even 2 years. And I want to start with the new ownership. How do you feel about the Angelos family ceding the reins?
I think there's a lot of positive feelings in Baltimore about that. And I think, you know, with any ownership, the worry is, how much are they going to spend and what are they going to do and how aggressive are they going to be? And I think the feeling in Baltimore is Ripken's involved, you know, which carries massive amounts of weight in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that he is involved on some level makes people have a really good feeling that this is, that it's going to be a good thing, that they're going to do it right. Like, you wouldn't get the Ripken name in Baltimore involved with baseball. That's like the stamp of approval. Like, you feel like, okay, he's going to okay that, you know, it's great. I mean, Baltimore is such a baseball town. I don't know if you've ever been down here, you know, Baltimore loves it, loves their Orioles here. But it's tough when you're struggling through 100 lost seasons after 100 lost seasons to maintain that interest, you know. But I mean, they are so young, they're so exciting. They're just kind of a different brand of baseball right now. I think, you know, they don't really carry themselves the same. Like, they are really a fun team to watch, and they're stealing bases and just doing all those things that we don't always see in baseball, you know. And they're so young. It's just it's hard to believe that you're looking up there and you're like, wow, this roster was, you know, playing the minor leagues, you know, last year, 2 years, 3 years ago, like,
Yeah. Now, with the new ownership and all these young players, do you anticipate, or do fans expect, I guess is the better question, extensions coming?
I would hope so. I mean, that's obviously the big worry is, right, what happens when you got to start paying for all these players? And I think that's what I was saying. I think you feel that this ownership seems to be willing to do that. From what I've read, I mean, I know this ownership, they don't talk to me, they don't ask my opinion. But again, having Ripken there leads the belief that yes, they're gonna keep the players they need to keep, and they're gonna do those right things. They're not gonna just, like, you know, turn players over and get rid of them when you have this young core that could do something.
Mm-hmm. Now, going into last year, nobody expected them to win the division. Nobody expected them to win 100 games. And part of that was because of their kind of thin starting pitching. They traded for Corbin Burnes in the offseason, maybe the biggest trade of the offseason. What is the expectations around their starting pitching this time around?
I think it's pretty high. I mean, I think pitching improved a lot by the end of the season. And it's funny because I don't know how the perception is outside of Baltimore. The feeling of Baltimore is everybody was disappointed, you know, with the playoff loss last year, and that it was pretty awful. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there was a lot of disappointment, because kind of like you said, I don't think people were ready for a 100-win season. We thought maybe we're just going to sneak in the playoffs, and then we're looking at the next season. So I think that while there was disappointment, it was still more like, we have gotten to this point. So I think that pitching can be a bit of a strength this year. You know, I think you've got this young roster, and you've got to hope that they can all go back and, you know, produce and play above their heads like they kind of did last year. You know what I mean? Like, it's they had these, you know, this young roster had, you know, this great season. They've got to go back and produce again. You can't have any kind of regression in that. And, you know, I think pitching wise, I mean, sure, you know, Batista not being here really, you know, that's something you're going to miss. But again, I think, you know, you move on and you see what happens here. So there's a lot of positive feelings on pitching in the roster in general.
Yeah, because their bullpen, I think, is what really carried them through the year, at least the first half of the year last year. And it was a scary bullpen. And in general, this team is just a really, I think they might be the scariest team in the league, you could say, because you just, you know, if they keep on their progression, they're going to be a really good team this year.
Yeah, and I think, again, one thing why they were so much fun to watch is, you know, and I'm sure you watch O's games, obviously, when they play the Blue Jays.
Yep.
You know, they played in a lot of close games, but they didn't necessarily have one person who you go like, okay, well, we, you know, Gunnar Henderson's going to come up and we got to wait for him to get a hit or something like that. It felt that anybody on any kind of given day could help do something. Like they truly were a good, solid team. You know, it wasn't like, all right, well, let's just get back around so we can get to the top of the order or something like that. It just really felt that on any given day, anybody could produce, and they're so interchangeable, and there's guys on the bench who come off and all of a sudden you're like, well, this is great. Like, so it just feels like a really good group of guys that you want to root for. And it doesn't feel like you're just relying on one or two people, you know, and they do those things. I mean, again, stealing bases and, you know, putting the ball in play. I mean, it's not like they're just going up there, like, you know, mashing home runs or anything like that. It's a lot of fun to watch. It's something different that we don't always see now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of jealous of that aspect of it. So, you know, the AL East is probably the toughest division. It definitely was last year, you know, with the Tampa Bay being Tampa Bay and the Yankees with their improvements. Do you think that the Orioles will improve? Like, is it their division to lose at this point still, or is it up in the air?
I mean, it seems like it's the Yankees division to lose right now, right? Isn't that what, you know, it always seems to be, but, you know, yes, I think it always should be this way, right? If you're the defending champ, you're the defending champ until you're not. And they haven't got worse since last year. So I think, sure. I mean, can there be regression? Can they not win 100 games? Yeah, but they could also still win the division and not win 100 games, you know? And It's a long season and a lot of things can happen, but they haven't got worse since last year. I mean, those young players are a year better and should be seasoned. And, you know, we'll see if Jackson Holliday is going to be up here at the start of the year, which, you know, that'd be exciting. But if he's not, that's fine. If they you know, want to leave him down for another month or so, like, I think that's fine as well. But yeah. That's people are really excited about that. I mean, you know. It's a pretty young infield you're going to put out there of unbelievable talent.
For sure, yeah. Jackson Holliday, eyes will be on him when eventually he does come up. So he's even if he comes in like a month late, he might be the odds-on favorite for Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, and I mean, it's crazy that you had the defending Rookie of the Year, you know, Gunnar Henderson. Mm-hmm. You know, and Rutschman, if I remember correctly, I don't think he came up to start the year. Didn't he come up in May, maybe? He might have.
Yeah, he came up late. He came up late.
Yeah, you know, same kind of thing. I mean, these are their last three big kind of, you know, draft picks. So I think it's kind of the same thing. Like it's fine. If he doesn't come until May, it's cool. I mean, it's a long season. Like, you know, he's got a long time to help to you know, provide some help up here. So I think everybody's excited to finally get him up here and see what he does, but no rush.
Yeah. Well, so with between the Orioles and the release of your book, the Life and Times of Forgotten Baseball Legend Pete Browning, the original Louisville Slugger, it sounds like you've got a really exciting year on your hands. It comes out in September.
Yep. So we're starting to get together some like events. We'll probably be doing like some kind of dual, obviously, as you talk, because, you know, a bit of my background is music. I don't play music, but maybe trying to put together some events where I'll be talking about the book. Of some musicians who will have some songs that are sort of related to the era, to him. Maybe if they're so inclined, they're going to write some songs about him. So we may have some kind of events like that. But we'll definitely have some events kind of leading up to that. I imagine I'll be out in Louisville around that time doing some events as well. But yeah, it's exciting right now, kind of in the home stretch to release it. It's, you know, you kind of work on it and, you know, read newspaper clippings and research for years and years, and to get a chance to kind of finally start talking about it with people like you and getting a chance to share and all the stuff that I've been sitting on and I feel like I want to say, it's fun to do. So I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me and, you know, helping kick off this process.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. It's going to be so much fun to be able to let loose all these facts and important things. And it sounds super exciting with all the incorporating the music into the release of the book as well. Like I'm jealous that I live in Ottawa, Ontario, and we have an independent league baseball team, but it's not a baseball town by any means. So there's not a lot of baseball stuff going on throughout the year other than some baseball games, but yeah, it's great that you have you're combining your two communities, the jam band community and the blue and well, three communities, bluegrass communities and the baseball community. We all get along very well.
Yes, and I think, I mean, we all have multiple passions. Why can't we do it all at one time? You know, we don't have to keep everything in separate boxes, you know. So
yeah, exactly.
Sports, love baseball. I love people playing acoustic guitars, so let's talk about baseball and have people play some amazing music. Would be a pretty perfect evening in my book.
For sure. Well, Tim Newby, thanks so much for joining me. The book is great. It, like I said, it'll be out in September. I've had the chance to read it, and it's a great read. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk about this. I appreciate your time, and thank you for the kind words about the book.
Th- Thanks again to Tim for joining me. That was a fun talk. Look for The Life and Times of Forgotten Baseball Legend Pete Browning, the original Louisville Slugger, available everywhere September. And look for Steve and I to have a regular Jays from Home episode next week. We'll talk all things Joey Votto, I suppose. Bye-bye.